Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Coming up on this week's show, one of the most anticipated remakes ever is finally coming.
It's not all about the Pentiums anymore.
And we get the story of 3D construction kit with Paul Gregory.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our incredible friends at Bitmap Books. Now, one of their titles, definitely worth checking out, is Game Boy, the Box Art Collection. They've brought together over 100 titles, the box art, photography, screenshots, and expert commentary as well, celebrating Nintendo's monochrome marvel. So if you want to get that book and the rest of their retro gaming collection, you can see them at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 345, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And great to have you joining us for another hour-ish of retro ramblings, where, of course, every weekend we bring you up to speed on all the big headlines from the world of retro from over the last 7 days. And we bring you a veteran of the industry on for an interview in the second half of the podcast. Now, every week, of course, we talk about remakes of classic video games, new titles that are coming out, games that we played growing up. But here's a question for you, lads. Have you ever tried to make your own video game?
I tried to make a point and click once. It was not very good at all. I think its main aims and focus were walking around the streets, talking to tramps, and it didn't work very well.
You've talked about this before, actually, haven't you?
Yeah. One day I'm going to dig the disc out.
I tried to make one when I was about 14, 15 on RPG Maker because I was obsessed with JRPGs. Spent weeks and weeks and weeks making it. But then to play it and it'd be about an hour long, which I guess is pretty good going. But if I remember rightly, it was just a really straightforward RPG.
You have this idea that, yeah. You know, you're going to do a whole game in a day.
Yeah, I'm going to make the best game ever in a day.
You realize it takes so long. Yeah.
See, I tried doing the first thing I did was a type-in adventure game with my friend Gary when we were at school. We tried to do that on the BBC Micros in BASIC. And then, obviously, adventure games are very complicated to make because you've got to have different options for the player and the story arc can change. So it completely fell apart and we never got around to finishing that. I did make a little shoot-em-up game, though, in shoot-em-up construction kit with my brother. I remember doing that on the Amiga. And then the topic of today's show, I remember playing with a bit at school, actually, and that was 3D construction kit. Now, weirdly, I remember my IT teacher bringing in a disc of it, and we used it for a lesson on the Acorn Archimedes, which obviously, you know, being a very educationally focused machine, I was quite interested to play with this piece of software that I'd read about in Amiga format and stuff like that. Later got a cover disc demo of it as well, I remember. But I think it just, packages like that, these kind of construction kits and JRPG makers, stuff like that, they just allow people like us who haven't really got much programming knowledge to be able to make our own games. And that was such a big deal back in the day.
Yeah, so like 3D construction kit is the subject of this week's interview with Paul Gregory, who's a programmer from Incentive Software, who were the guys behind it. And they created this engine called the Freescape engine. Now, you might remember such amazing games as Castle Master as well. Mm. That was also run on the engine. And 3D construction kit was insane. I remember trying to make the city center in my kind of town. And I was like looking at areas of it and stuff. And I think I could only make a small area of it. But the kind of usability and ease of use for 3D Construction Kit was amazing, like for back then. And it came out for so many systems. Like, can you believe it? It was out for the Spectrum as well. So, you know, you could create 3D environments on the Spectrum, which was pretty insane. And it works so efficiently as well. I think with the limited power and kind of limited memory that you had, being able to construct these 3D worlds or objects was just insane. And I absolutely love this interview. So Paul, he worked for Incentive Software, and that they were the folks behind it.
And when we were doing some research for this as well, you actually found a website, didn't you, dedicated to 3D Construction Kit games, and there's so many you can download, and people are still making them today.
Yeah, there's games for like the Commodore 64 as well, which was a huge system for it. There's ones for the Plus 4. There's like the whole thing about 3D Construction Kit was that it was customizable. So you can change the menus, you could add your own sounds in 3D Construction Kit 2 as well. And people created some amazing titles with that. I think it was an amazing piece of software. And it was like a game engine out there when, to be honest, not that many game engines were out there. Like, people would release individual games that would just do stuff, but there wouldn't be a unified engine on lots of different platforms.
And I remember using it on, like I said, the Acorn Archimedes and that demo I had on the Amiga. And the fact that it was all drag and drop as well, it meant that you didn't really need, you know, any programming knowledge to make your own 3D worlds. And today, I mean, you know, with the rise of the metaverse and virtual reality, it seems very on trend now. But obviously they were doing this like 30 years ago. Yeah. I think in America it was actually released as, wasn't it Virtual Reality?
Yeah, Virtual Reality Studio, that was the one. Yeah. And it was so ahead of its time. And I found a lot of like 3D programs were really intimidating back then. When you tried to pick them up, it felt like, you know, you had to have an understanding of like complex maths, or you had to know about like rendering and stuff like that, where this was just like pick up objects, stretch object, fly around the space, you know, walk around, and you could add like triggers and stuff and really turn it into a puzzle or a game like that.
Yeah, so if you ever had any interest in making 3D worlds, or you used 3D Construction Kit back in the day, such an interesting interview with this week's special guest, the legendary Paul Gregory. He's coming up on the show in around half an hour from now. Now, we have got lots of big news stories to get through this week. It's actually been quite a busy week for news, including, we need to talk about this, Joe's dreams have come true. We're finally getting a proper, official GoldenEye 007 remake.
Yeah, this was big news for me. And, you know,
have you picked yourself up off the floor yet?
Joe, as well. I love GoldenEye. You know.
Yeah, this was really, really cool. So a lot's been announced this weekend, just gone. I mentioned on last week's show that it was Nintendo Direct. New Zelda games, lots of new modern stuff, but a couple of retro Brits. But yeah, GoldenEye 007, 25 years in the making this has been. And also, weirdly, really close to the 60th anniversary of the Bond movies. Kind of timed that really well. But yeah, it's going to be coming to Xbox and to Nintendo Switch. But I don't know if you guys have seen, interestingly, each game's a different build, apparently. I don't know if you've read anything about that. So they're both by Rare, which I love. I'm so glad that Rare are behind this, because obviously they're behind the original. But as it goes, is the Switch version is a port of the N64 game, but obviously it's HD remaster and all that.
And optimized and stuff.
And optimized
to run well.
Yeah, on the Switch. And it will include online multiplayer, whereas the Xbox version will have split-screen multiplayer, which is a must because it's GoldenEye, but it won't have online multiplayer. And essentially they're saying it's because they've rebuilt the game from the ground up. They've completely rebuilt it. However, they've said, you know, it is true to GoldenEye. It is a remake. It plays the same and everything like that. And they've confirmed that it's exactly the same, etc. But I just think that's really interesting that the Xbox version they've built from the ground up, but the Switch version is a remaster. And I don't know if that's because if it's going to go on the virtual console, you know, on the N64.
That's what I think. I think the Switch probably has a better background in emulating N64 stuff and running that, even though previously when trying to run GoldenEye, it was always really tough to do, because the way that GoldenEye was built was you know, it specifically did stuff for the N64 hardware that, you know, is really hard to emulate. And I think they've probably focused in and spent time on that code for the Switch version, but they've had to go with something like another engine, probably Unity or something like that, for the Xbox version. But obviously copying it exactly and keeping it close to that original, which is really great. And, you know, this to me, it's an own goal. This should have like gone in years ago.
They've tried so many times.
The fact that they're doing it well, like it would have been awful if a glitchy called a GoldenEye came out, you know. And
this, well, we haven't played it yet, but I'm sure it'll be
good. give it a chance, Ravi.
And I think this is going to bring back that kind of cooperative GoldenEye multiplayer, sitting there with your friends. And we definitely need to have a GoldenEye session on this.
Oh god, yeah, I think that's 100% on the cards when this comes out. Just a video, an hour-long video of me battering you both on it. We'll see. That's what the fans need. But yeah, no, I'm really looking forward to this. It's coming to Game Pass on Xbox as well, so if you've got Game Pass, it'll be free on, well, it's not free on there, but you know, you pay your monthly subscription, which is really, really cool. I think most Rare games do, because obviously they're you know, they owned by Microsoft. I can't remember the story there, but really, really excited about this. Have we got a? I'm not sure if we've got a date on it yet.
It says no. I don't think there is one on here yet.
Yeah, I think it's coming. It's coming soon, kind of thing. But it was also announced as part of kind of not the same package, but in the same announcement for the Switch, also for the N64. Just a quick mention: Pokemon Stadium, Mario Party, Pilot Wings 64. 1080 Snowboarding, Excitebike 64, as well as GoldenEye. They're the N64 games that should be coming out of the Switch soon. And then we're also getting GoldenEye, but not all those other games on the Xbox, which I think is really cool, though.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, with winter coming here in the Northern Hemisphere, good time to get your cozies on and relive some of those memories. So apparently it's going to be arriving soon.
The fact that it's 4K as well, and like... Yeah. You know, they haven't done any changes on the characters. Like, they've got a little trailer, and you've obviously got James Bond going at the front. And he still looks like he's got that kind of chunk to him and that squareness and stuff. And I really love that. You know, when you shot them in a certain place, they react and fall over. Yeah. And I think all that is essential to the game. But having it in 4K is just going to make it
I hope Dr. Doke is still in there.
Oh, he's got to be in there, right?
He's got to be.
So look out for that landing, hopefully any day now. Now, speaking of things from 25 years ago, that unfortunately this one is no longer there anymore. Intel is finally retiring the Pentium. I imagine Weird Al is getting pretty upset over this.
I guess it's the Pentium name, right? It's still not rocking Pentium chips, are they?
Well, they still release CPUs, apparently, under the brand of Pentium. Not that I've seen any around for, God, about 15 years. But apparently they have been making them, and the Celeron line, which are their now entry-level CPUs.
Okay.
So they've been putting Pentium chips into like their really low-end laptops, well,
like office or industry kind of stuff, I guess.
Yeah. But it turns out that apparently they're having a bit of a restructure in 2023. And Intel are now saying they're getting rid of the Pentium brand after all this time, and the Celeron brand as well, actually. And they're just going to be replacing it with something they're calling Intel Silicon. So that's going to be the new brand.
Do you remember the impact of Pentium? We were Amiga users, and for us that was the kind of absolute destruction of our machine. Everybody just dropped everything and went onto Pentium, from what I remember. What are your memories, Dan?
I remember kids at school talking about it, because I remember when the 486 machines started landing. That would have been about, what, 92, 93?
Like,
I remember those kind of
been
around. Yeah, when they were getting pretty fast. And then I remember a kid at school telling me about this new CPU. Now, they're all like, I had a few friends at school who were PC users by then. I was still rocking my Amiga 1200. And they'd always be like, oh, you know, the PC's so much better now. We've got, you know, the 586 is coming out soon. And that ended up obviously being rebranded as the Pentium. But really, I mean, Pentium was kind of the trademark of power back then, wasn't it?
Yeah.
If you had a Pentium machine, it was a high-end rig.
Yeah, and like, you know, it lasted for such a long period. So like, you know, I think you went up to Pentium 4, didn't you? And that seemed to be the really popular kind of era that I remember. And it owes a lot to gaming as well. So stuff like Half-Life wouldn't have happened without that. Serious Sam as well, I remember, was a big title on the Pentiums. And even The Sims as well. Yeah, but there was also early titles like Magic Carpet and stuff. And for me, it was that real kind of step up where PC became that serious kind of gaming machine, and it could take on the console and go a lot further than the consoles as well.
I remember the Pentium being famous for obviously that bug.
I think it was the bug. Or Y2K or no?
Something to do with Division, I remember. And actually, Intel recalled them all. And there are still a few of them out there. I think it was the 66 megahertz version of it. And you could test it by doing some kind of calculation in Excel, and it would get it wrong if it was this specific Pentium version that had the bug in there as well. Although I think Microsoft kind of patched Excel so it would work properly on it after that. But there are some YouTube videos if you want to see it. It was like really, I think the first time that there'd ever been a full recall of a CPU in the industry. And it was in December 1994. And it cost Intel $475 million loss to recover and replace them all.
It was a real kind of mad time because all these PC brands were out there. There were so many PC brands and shops and stuff. And I do remember like people's parents buying Pentium setups, and suddenly you had this like powerful computer sitting in their house that was connected to the internet, that had CD-ROM. And you know, before it was just like probably a word processor or something. And then everybody was like, right, I could do this, I could play these games on it. And it really got a lot of people into PC gaming.
Yeah, and I think particularly that time, that kind of early to mid 90s, hardcore PC gamers will be upgrading their rig like every 2 years at that stage. You know, you buy a 486 to play Doom properly. Then the Pentium came along. I want to play Quake now. So, you know, you buy a Pentium machine. And then the 3D accelerators started coming out and everything. So it was a very expensive time to be a PC gamer back in the 90s. But obviously the Pentium, just a legendary brand. I was actually surprised it was still around in 2022. But Intel are finally retiring after over 25 years of service. So rest in peace, the Intel Pentium. And what about this? Memories of, for me, sunny days at the seaside in Scarborough with my brother playing Operation Wolf. What a game. That is, to me, one of the best arcade shooters ever.
I remember going to Benidorm, good old Benidorm, when I was about 9 or 10 years old, and they had an Operation Wolf down in the bar. And I think it was about 10 cents ago because it was in Spain. And just playing it every night and completing it pretty much every single night and just being obsessed with it. And just absolutely loved it. Loved the Uzi, you know, the fixed Uzi on the game, which looked like a real gun. And just, you know, being Commando, being Arnold Schwarzenegger from Commando, essentially being that one-man army and absolutely loving it. But it's not really been around for a while, has it?
No, but it's coming back.
It's coming back. It's coming back. So we got Operation Wolf. Operation Wolf Returns First Mission, which is a remake of the 1987 version, which will be coming out, once again announced this weekend, will be coming to the Switch later this year. We've just got autumn this year. What do you think of the look of it, Dan? The kind of artwork style of it?
I mean, I've only seen a couple of screenshots of it so far. I'm not sure if there's like a full video
trailer or anything. It's just screenshots by the looks of things so far.
I think it kind of reminds awful. Me. It looks horrible.
Well, again, it's kind of because this is a remake of the original game, isn't it? And it was one of the first on-rail shooter games, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Operation Wolf. So I think, you know, if they did this in like, you know, full modern 4K and everything, it might kind of take away a bit of the feel of the original game. Although this, to me, looks a bit like, you know, look at the buildings and everything. Kind of reminds me of like Call of Duty 4 on the Xbox kind of graphics.
To me, it looks like a flash game and really badly, cheaply done. Like the characters in it, they've got really thin legs, spindly legs, but huge shoulders. I don't know what they're on.
They missed leg day.
Yeah, some like
riding emus.
shoulder steroids or something. And they've got these really like small squashed in kind of heads. It does look really, and the on-screen menus don't look that good either. I've also had a look at some of the screenshots, which are the animations between. So they've got like a little cartoon kind of that's going on between,
yeah,
between some of the shots, and that kind of looks all right, kind of switchy. But the main gameplay to me, I don't know what the hell they're aiming for, because Operation Wolf, when I first saw it, it looked like a Schwarzenegger film. It had that kind of, they could have gone like 80s vibe, think, you know what I mean?
I think that's what they're trying to do personally. I'm torn whether I like the look of it or hate the look of it. And I think that's what they're trying to do, that they're trying to play on the silliness of it. You know, I referenced Commando there, and, you know, Ravi, you pointed out that essentially the bad guys in it and stuff, and some of the characters are like hugely muscly, but with these like tiny, skinny little legs, you know, which was the case, you know, back then. I mean, you know, not to say Arnold Schwarzenegger skipped leg day or anything. I'm sure he had absolutely massive legs, but...
Wouldn't say that to his face.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that to his face, but I think that's like the silly look they're going for. You can obviously tell, I agree, it's not like AAA. It's not the new Call of Duty. I am a little bit worried because I was really excited for the House of the Dead remake, and then I'll be honest, I didn't think that played very well. I think it was a bit clunky.
And that is the same developers, actually. So it's Microids who are behind this, who did the House of the Dead.
Is it the same developers? I was going to say, I was trying to find out, and the graphics,
same studio.
The graphics look a bit same. They look the same, and I wasn't, unfortunately, I'm usually quite a positive guy, but I wasn't very impressed with the House of the Dead remake.
It's probably triggered me a bit, because I've seen remakes of stuff like Cannon Fodder, which kind of came out for the PC and stuff and looked like this kind of style and really just didn't have anything relating to the old game in my eyes. But maybe it'll be different. Maybe it'll play different, or maybe there'll be
It's hard to tell from screenshots in it.
Exactly. Like weird, because I can see that they are going for like the trucks and stuff in it. They're going for this like shadery modern look as well. So, but then I just look at it and it looks like a Flash game to me. it's tough.
It is a
tough Microids one. Have got a good recent track record in, you know, kind of reviving retro titles. They did that, North and South, the remake that came out. They did Oddworld New and Tasty. They're doing Flashback 2 at the moment. Beyond the Steel Sky came out through that studio too. So, they've got some kind of big IPs from the past that they're bringing back. I've seen they've just done a new Asterix game.
And now that you mentioned Beyond the Steel Sky, I remember first seeing the screenshots of that and thinking, no. And then later on thinking, actually, this is quite... So, you know, maybe it's just that it's so early or it needs a bit more polish, you know?
Yeah, and I think especially with a game as famous as Operation Wolf, kind of, you know, you're that used to seeing the original graphics.
Totally, yeah.
Seeing something else called that, it's always a bit of a, handbrake turn kind of, isn't it? Like, oh, what? Hang on a minute. But, I mean, I think it's really cool that the franchise is coming back. I'd love it if they do actually make this into a new arcade cabinet, though. How good would that be?
Oh, that would be cool.
That would be very cool. That would be really, really cool. I mean, it's coming out on, like, everything. So maybe, you know, it's coming out on Meta. It's coming out on Steam.
Oh, wow. Virtual reality version of...
Yeah.
That would be good, actually.
And then well, you don't have the spindly legs on Meta.
yeah, maybe.
It's also exploding everywhere.
Your own legs. PS4, PS5, Xbox One, Xbox Series X. So, you know, as a Quest game, a Meta game, that might be pretty cool.
Yeah, because to me, Operation Wolf, you need playing it with a controller. It just feels weird. You need the guns, you know what I mean? And obviously, in virtual reality, you've got your two kind of handsets, your controllers, which I think it would actually work quite well in that.
Yeah, I think it'll work quite well on there. I'll come and play it at yours when you buy it, Dan, when you're drunk.
See if you get seasick. So, Operation Wolf is back. So if you want to read more about that, I'll put that in our show notes at theretrohour.com. And we've got some more news about this huge Atari 50 project to tell you about in just a minute. And of course, our special guest, Paul Gregory, giving us the inside story on 3D Construction Kit. Before we do that, let's take a quick moment to give a massive thank you to our sponsor, BetterHelp. Now, we love working with BetterHelp. And, you know, personally, us guys have all been big believers for many years that mental health is so important.
Oh, God, 100%. And, you know, I'm... I'm the resident retro hour mental health guy. I'd like to think I'm the guy who, you know, who tries to be quite open about it and stuff.
You look after us all.
I try to look after you guys. And, you know, sometimes it's hard to talk to the people about these things, but it massively, massively helps. And it massively helps with the likes of BetterHelp, because it doesn't necessarily have to be over the phone. It can be by chat. It can be by text. You know, I think that's really, really fantastic if it's something that you're worried about. And sometimes it's really hard to focus on the positive. And sometimes, you know, you end up focusing on what the problem is. And that's something I've struggled with personally recently. I've gone through a lot of changes in the last couple of months, a lot of changes at home, a lot of changes with work and stuff like that. And sometimes you just sit there and you worry about the problems. But, you know, when you actually get to talk about these things and either, you know, even talk about it out loud or even just talk to, you know, somebody on text, it really, really helps change that mindset. And actually, you start thinking about the future and start thinking about the positive and the solutions of how that can happen. And BetterHelp is really, really good for that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, they can help you become a better problem solver. So I think, you know, we've all faced challenges in the last couple of years. I mean, this year, you know, I've had a big change. I changed my career this year.
Yeah.
My wife did the same as well. You know, it's been a big change for a lot of us. And obviously, the last couple of years, I mean, the whole world has changed really. So a lot of us have got, you know, problems that we need to solve. And a therapist can help you become a better problem solver, help you achieve your goals as well, no matter how big or small. So if you've ever thought of giving therapy a try, and I think that is one misconception, people think that therapy is only for, like, you know, the rich and famous. But BetterHelp is actually a great option. Not only is it convenient, you can do it from home, it's accessible, but it's really affordable as well. And the whole thing is entirely online. So you can get matched with a therapist after filling out a brief survey, and you can switch at any time at all. So if you want to be a better problem solver, therapy can get you there. So why don't you visit this exclusive link, and we'll give you 10% off your first month of BetterHelp. So that is betterhelp.com/retro. Betterhelp.com/retro. And I'll put that in our show notes as well. And a big thank you to our friends at BetterHelp for their support of our show. Now, of course, one of the most famous companies from back in the day, the OG video games companies, is celebrating a huge anniversary this year, Atari 50. Now, this is an incredible-looking package, actually, they're going to be bringing out very soon, that has documentaries in there. It's got a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff as well, and also 103 classic Atari games that is going to be brought to modern platforms. Now, this is something we've been keeping an eye on over the last couple of months as well. They did announce originally it was going to be over 100 games, but it looks like now, ahead of the release on November 8th, there's been, I think this might be a bit of a leak actually, because a European retailer put this list up over the weekend, and it turns out there is 103 games in here, spread across all of the, you know, various arcade cabinets, six different console libraries as well. Some of them are reimagined, some of them are newly coded games and ports as well. And actually, it looks pretty good, but there are some glaring omissions in here as well. Now, this is quite interesting. It's an article on Ars Technica, and they're kind of talking about, you know, some of the big games from Atari's history that hasn't made this selection. For example, there's no Paperboy in here. And you might be thinking, you know, if you're celebrating 50 years of Atari, games like that have got to be in there, surely. But you remember that Atari was actually two different companies, wasn't it? Because in 1983, they sold the home division to Jethro Mill, who turned it into, you know, mainly a computer company. And then the arcade branch of it went to Warner Brothers. So that's the reason that really there are not many, actually any arcade titles after 1983 in this collection. So that's explained in here.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the kind of omissions in this. But also just to highlight, like we've mentioned before, this is a wicked pack. Like, you know, Atari 50 for about £31. And, you know, you can get over 100 games for it. And a lot of them haven't been released for years as well, for like a huge variety of platforms. There's seven different hardware platforms and exclusive interviews and stuff. So this is a wicked pack. Like, maybe they're saving these for a second release, do you think? Or something afterwards? Or maybe they don't have the rights, like you say, Dan.
Maybe I think it's a rights thing rather than a second release. But it doesn't explain why there's no Alien versus Predator on the Jaguar.
Yeah.
Which I think is a big glaring omission because of, you know, the Jaguar didn't have the best library, but that's highly regarded as one of the best games for it.
I imagine, again, that will be getting the rights renewed for both of those franchises. Because, you know, it's two massive movie franchises there.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, the standout game for the Jaguar games for me is probably Tempest 2000. That's meant to be a really good version of Tempest. But then the other ones, you know, is Atari Karts on there. But then it's just like Cybermorph, Fight for Your Life, Missile Command 3D. So,
have you ever played Cybermorph before?
I haven't, but I've heard it's not as bad as the Angry Video Game Nerd made out to it.
I mean, it's not as fun as like Star Fox, for example, but I actually have fun with Cybermorph, and the second one's probably the best version, which I've got on the, probably the only good game that I've got on the CD unit on the Jaguar. But actually, yeah, it's not as bad as people make out, I don't think.
I think this is a pretty good achievement, actually, because a lot, if you think and look back at the video game companies now, so many rights have been sold off and companies have changed, that who would have like the rights to over 100 games, you know? I think that's pretty awesome that they've got that. And I couldn't see, like, you know, Amiga or Acorn or some other kind of company having this much stuff, maybe apart from Nintendo, who really hold all that stuff close to their chest.
You know, Nintendo kind of put it out just kind of incrementally, don't they, on their platforms, like they're doing now on the Switch with the older libraries they put on there. But one thing that really inspires a lot of confidence for me in this is the Digital Eclipse are working on this, who did the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Cowabunga collection recently. So they're going to be reimagining like six of the games as well. And okay, I think, you know, based, I still haven't played the Cowabunga collection yet, but based on reviews I've seen of it in YouTube videos, it's actually been reviewed really well from the videos I've seen.
And they've got some good people on board. So Mike Mika, who we've had on the podcast before, is the president as well, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah. You know, I was playing the Cowabunga collection only last night, and the port of it feels perfect. I mean, I've only played the two arcade games so far, played them through and completed them both last night. And they both feel perfect. And, you know, you can rewind them and, you know, save state and all that kind of stuff. So if it's, you know, some of the same people on board with this, I'm sure then it'll be a hit.
And what I think is really good is, I mean, I'd say as retro gamers, I don't know about you guys, I've probably played as many Atari 2600 games as I want to play. You know, they don't hold my attention all that well, if I'm honest. But a lot of the older Atari arcade games do. And when you get to stuff like the Lynx, I mean, they've got stuff in here like, you know, Scrapyard Dog, Turbo Sub Warbirds is going to be coming out as well, Super Asteroids and Missile Command. Then on the Jaguar, Atari Karts, which is kind of
is there Chips Challenge?
Chips Challenge isn't on the Atari Lynx list. Yeah. Again, I imagine because it was probably a different company made it and maybe they haven't got the rights.
California Games as well.
No, it's not on there either. But they're saying that they were really trying, apparently, to support the Lynx two-player link play mode in the games, but they haven't been able to get it working, unfortunately. So it means that, you know, these games are not going to be two-player on the Lynx. But I always get the idea that there are probably a huge amount of retro gaming fans who have never really delved into the more obscure platforms like the Atari Jaguar and the Lynx, even though they've heard a lot about them. So it kind of opens these games up that previously were only playable on that hardware. So if you guys want to play Atari Karts, you can do it easily now.
I hear you raving about Atari Karts quite a lot. So
I don't
want to
hype it too much, by the way.
And this is why I mean, obviously you could just go emulate them. You know, I'm just going to throw that out there. But this is why I'm disappointed, because I wanted that modern version. You know, I wanted to play Alien vs. Predator on my Xbox Series X. Like, you know, I love that. You know, I love my retro on, you know, new consoles and stuff. But, you know, I can play Trevor McFur at least on the Atari Jaguar via my Xbox. So it's still pretty cool.
You know, I'm interested to find out, because I've got Missile Command 3D as one of the Atari Jaguar games, which was the only Atari Jaguar game that supported the unreleased virtual reality headset. So I'm wondering, you know, if they release this on the PS5, is it going to support the PSVR?
That would be very interesting. It would be very cool as well. I have my doubts. Feel like that's a lot of effort to put in for one game out of like 103.
That would be amazing though.
Yeah.
And Tempest 2000, obviously Jeff Minter's, you know, I think my favorite version of Tempest. He did the new one was pretty good. We played that at Play Expo once, didn't we? But yeah, that, you know, a lot of people kind of rave about that as one of the best Atari Jaguar games. So yeah, it looks like it's going to be a really, really good collection, and just the amount of extra bonus material they're putting in there. I think it's like an hour-long documentary that's going to be included with it too. So that's due to land on November 8th, and we'll bring you more news on that when we can. Now, there has been a big retro FPS revival in the last couple of years. And I remember us guys getting very excited when a game called Iron Fury was announced a couple of years ago. I don't know if you guys have played that. I downloaded that game. Really enjoyed it. Kind of reminded me very much of those mid-90s PC shooters, definitely in the vein of something like Duke Nukem 3D.
Yeah.
The original Iron Fury game.
The build engine look, but kind of on steroids and with loads of extra effects and stuff. And it also reminded me of Shadow Warrior as well, which yeah. was one of those, but a bit more pixely.
Yeah,
it, great fun to play that game.
It reminded me of like a step up from, I don't want to, maybe from Blood, you know, like kind of Doom and Blood. But like, I think Shadow Warrior and Duke Nukem 3D are like really good comparable, you know, there. We did cover the game when it came out, and it did look really, really good. But I love what they've done with the sequel that they've just announced, Phantom Fury. I really, really...
Now, was this another one that was announced at Nintendo Direct?
It was. What a week. So it isn't just for the Switch. It's coming out PlayStation 5, Xbox, PC, Steam, etc. And it's going to be an early 2023 release. It's a direct sequel to Iron Fury, so it continues the story. But I absolutely love what they've done with the aesthetic and look of the game. So I thought it was going to just be more of the same. But essentially, what they've done is they've kind of taken the graphics into the next generation after that mid-90s generation. And the graphics are now similar to, I kind of associate them with like Half-Life, the original Time Splitters, maybe a little bit like GoldenEye, but a bit better. You know, that kind of early, like late 90s, early 2000s look. And I think they've nailed it.
It could have come out in 1999, this game, couldn't
it? Yeah, for the PC.
I think also it looks Xboxy. Xbox original, Halo kind of that kind of look. You know, whilst that, also combining
99 to 2003 kind of look, isn't it?
Yeah, kind of like it's just edging on a little bit of BioShock, but not that kind of vintage look. But you know, just the FPS style.
Now you mentioned Halo there as well, and looking at some of the screenshots on the Nintendo Life article that I put in our show notes, some of the weapons look straight out of Halo, don't they?
Yeah, they do. It reminds me of like a crossover of like the weapons anyway. Halo, Turok, Time Splitters, just really in that kind of vein of like...
Unreal Tournament.
Unreal Tournament,
Or like, you know, when it's got the jungle sections, it looks well. Unreal Tournament 2003, which was like a second version of it,
It looks really good. And, you know, I really need to play the first one. You know, you mentioned that you played it there, Dan. And I really got into, you know, like Doom and Doom clones about a year ago, playing through loads of them.
You were playing them all, weren't you?
Playing through all of them. And I just never got around to Iron Fury, you know, before I played through like Shadow Warrior and stuff like that. And I just never got to Iron Fury. So maybe it's time for me to revisit that now this has been announced and see what I think of it. Maybe in time for Phantom Fury to come out and then play that one.
Well, this game's coming out next year, 2023. I love the fact as well that 'cause it's set a few years after the original, with Shelley Bombshell Harrison, now set in the full 3D world. You have to use a bionic arm in here as well. But I do love the fact that, like you said, they've kind of moved up a generation. So if the original game had to come out in, like, you know, 1996, this is probably what the sequel would have looked like in 1999-2000.
Yeah, absolutely. I reckon, you know, you hit the nail on the head there. If the original game came out in 96, then this one came out in 2000. Like, the look of it, like a really nice 2000, because obviously it's all HD and quite smooth, and the frame rate and stuff looks really good. But yeah, I'm excited for this one.
It's still kind of got some pixely shading in there, which is nice. Like, you look at stuff a bit closer, like the guns, they've kind of got that non-anti-aliased look.
Yeah.
You know, like, just a bit kind of chunky and edgy, and like not every line is smooth in there, which is quite nice, actually.
Yeah, I really like that, you know, style, because obviously it's very purposeful, you know. And there's even a nice moment in the trailer when you go up to a vending machine and, you know, all the text on the vending machine is like, it's all pixelated and unreadable, which is what would happen, you know, kind of like in those early games, you know, I say early games, but that kind of like early sixth generation, that's what it would be like, you know.
The like how they applied textures and stuff.
Yeah. The textures look exactly, you know, like what they would have looked like. And it makes it really nostalgic. It does make it, you know, it really takes you back to kind of like 20, 22 years ago.
before Crisis changed everything. You know what, actually, I'm
Well, I'm looking at the trailer now, and you know, there's bits in there. It kind of reminds me in some ways of the Duke Nukem Forever kind of trailer, you know, from back in 2001.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I've just been reading that apparently Sherry Harrison was meant to be a character in Duke Nukem Forever that got dropped. So there's definite nods to that in here.
It reminds me of Serious Sam as well.
So obviously Duke Nukem Forever came out and wasn't the... I think I'm kind of understating things if I say it wasn't well received, which I don't think anything that was kind of, you know, in development for that long would be. But I think if the kind of, you know, 3D Realms are involved in this, obviously, so if they're kind of making, you know, Duke Nukem as we wished it was, Duke Nukem Forever, then I think that is definitely a big selling point in this game.
And if we're mentioning all these FPSs that are totally different that it all reminds us of, so they seem to have found that right kind of period and that right kind of frame of reference, which is really nice.
Yeah, so it looks really good. That's going to be coming out next year. So if you want to check out the trailer, I'll put that and all the stories. I do every week. You don't have to Google around or anything. You'll find them all in your podcast app, or you can head and follow the links on our website at theretrohour.com. Now, we are going to get the story of the legendary 3D construction kit with this week's special guest, Paul Gregory. He'll be on the show in just a minute. Now, before we do that, let's just take a quick moment to give a big thank you to this week's sponsor, our friends at ExpressVPN. Now, what about this for an analogy? Are you a fan of Eminem, Ravi?
Yeah. I used to love a bit of Slim Shady and Dr. Dre back in the days.
Well, watching Netflix without using ExpressVPN would be like buying tickets to go and see Eminem, but only being allowed to watch the opening act.
Oh, that would be awful.
Imagine that you get to see Vanilla Ice and not Eminem. Not that I think Vanilla Ice would ever open for Eminem, but you get the idea. Well, ExpressVPN, what they do is, and actually this is really good because I've been away in Spain this week, and using ExpressVPN on my phone meant that I could continue watching shows on Netflix that are only available in the UK. Because, you know, there are so many. I think there are around 90 different Netflix libraries around the world that, due to licensing and region differences, they have specific libraries and shows that you can usually only watch in that region. So you're paying every month. I mean, I think I pay about 13 quid a month for Netflix, but you're not getting access to the entire library. But using ExpressVPN opens up the whole thing.
Yeah, it basically allows you to unblock your content, and it means that you can change your location online. So even if you're like watching something in the UK and you want to watch it when you have gone on holiday, or you want to watch something from another country, which I've actually been doing, which is pretty awesome because I've watched so much Netflix that I've kind of run out of content to watch. And I've been using the US Netflix, and there's some exclusives on there that I absolutely love.
There's a load on the US one that we don't get here.
Oh, yeah. So I don't know if you've seen a film called This Is the End, which is absolutely awesome with Seth Rogen in it. And it's kind of a really apocalyptic film, but also Taxi Driver, which is just an absolute classic. And of course, all of you guys will love Knight Rider, the TV show with Michael Knight and Kit, our classic. You can get that on the US Netflix, and that is made much easier using ExpressVPN.
And the thing about ExpressVPN is, it is dead easy to use as well, isn't it?
It's so simple. I've got it installed on my phone. I just have it on my laptop. It's got blazing fast speeds, like really fast. You know, you can stream in HD. There's not any buffering, even though you're going from another country. It's compatible with all your devices, so phones, laptops, your media consoles, smart TVs, and you can go to 94 different countries, which is amazing. You can gain thousands of shows, lots of content, not just Netflix as well. It works with other streaming services like iPlayer, YouTube, and much more.
Yeah, so you're paying for these services already. Why don't you get the value for money that you deserve instead of just getting a fraction of their content? Get your money's worth. And actually, of course, we've got you an incredible offer. If you use our exclusive link, expressvpn.com/retro, make sure that you use that and you will get 3 months of ExpressVPN on top of a one-year plan for free. So that's expressvpn.com/retro. I'll put that in our show notes as well. And a massive thank you to our mates at ExpressVPN for their support of our podcast. And just a quick heads up, if you were a patron of this show, you'd be getting a few extra news stories right about now. We do that every week for our patrons.
Yeah, it kind of started off as, you know, we were going through a phase of the retro 2 hour, and we had to cut a couple of stories.
We already and we are the retro 2 hour now.
Yeah, we already are.
To the retro 3 hour.
And we never really agreed on it, did we? Like, we were having to cut the odd story and we were keeping them in for our Patreons. And we just kind of kept doing it. And now it's become a thing where we now just give an extra, like, sometimes it's one, sometimes it's three extra stories, just to give that little bit back to say thank you, you know, to all of our supporters, really.
Yeah, if you back us on Patreon, you get the normal podcast ad-free. We try and get it out early, you know, whenever we can most weeks. You also get access to our second patrons-only podcast, The After Hours Show, that comes out every month as well. And, of course, at the end of the month, that is going to be our patrons hangout. This is where we all get together once a month, completely nerd out about all things retro, all things tech. So if you'd like to join the Retro Hour patron community, all the details are on our website at theretrohour.com.
And if you can't join our Retro Hour patron as well, you could leave us a review, which would really help the show as well on iTunes or on any of the stuff like Apple Podcasts.
Yeah, they definitely help us get in front of new people as well. So any way you can support the show, massively appreciated. Right, then next, we're going to get the story of classics like 3D Construction Kit with our special guest, incentive software legend, Paul Gregory, is next on the Retro Hour podcast.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time for the highlight of the show when, of course, we welcome on a veteran of the industry to hear some stories about games, about products, about companies that we grew up hearing about and products that we grew up using. So, and today we're going to be hearing some incredible stories from Incentive Software, which is a company we've not really covered all that much before, and of course, famous for so many incredible games and products, including 3D Construction Kits. Let's welcome on our special guest this week, Paul Gregory. How are you doing, Paul?
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, really appreciate you joining us. Now, before we get into kind of your time at Incentive and products like 3D Construction Kit, we also like to kind of go back to day one with our guests and kind of find out where your journey in the industry began. I mean, do you remember, you know, when you were young, when did you first see a video game then? When did you first experience it?
So my first exposure to video games would have been the plug-in to the TV Pong game. That was popular back in the 70s, early 70s, Christmas present. Had about two or three games on it and a couple of controllers. Great fun. And that followed shortly by my friend getting hold of an Atari 2600, and that took precedent then because that was far better. So I can remember very clearly the sort of lead up to getting my first home computer. It's very clear in my mind. I can remember the day. It was at school. In third or fourth year secondary school, and my maths technical drawing teacher bought in a ZX81 and held it up in front of the class and gave us the opportunity to have a play during break time, which I definitely took up and haven't looked back since, really. I remember going back to my mum and dad and asking for one immediately and got one the next weekend. That lasted maybe 6 weeks, maybe a couple of months before I got frustrated with the limitations of the ZX81 and its 1K memory and black and white screen and flickering and everything, and upgraded to a Spectrum 16K.
How did you start programming then? Were you buying like magazines and doing the type-in listings like we all did?
Yeah, that was definitely my first introduction. So basic programming, typing in from Sinclair User and other such magazines with my mum. Unfortunately, the dedicated person sitting behind me reading out byte by byte while I typed it in. Really good fun, and learned from that.
And I wonder, were you playing any like adventure titles on there? Because there was like lots of text adventures and stuff.
Yeah, I think a lot of the early type-ins in the magazines were text adventures because they were so simple to do and the graphics were so difficult to achieve. So yeah, I did play a lot of text adventures. back in those days. Yeah.
I don't know if you remember, there was a series of programming magazines by, I think it was Marshall Cavendish put them out, called Input.
Yes.
Yeah, and I remember following that, typing in a text adventure on the Commodore with my mum. And yeah, I think we typed in all parts of it, tried to run it right at the end, and it took us about 6 weeks to do, then it failed. There was obviously an error somewhere in that code.
Yeah, the fun ones, the basic ones were okay because they sort of made sense when you were typing them in, and in, on the Spectrum in particular, you were sort of forced into typing in the right words because you didn't type in. You didn't type print, for example, you pressed P and the word came up. So making a mistake was very was less easy. But typing in the assembly programs out of the magazines was really interesting, which was just a huge array of decimal bytes, and getting every one of those right and having no idea if it didn't work at the end, which one was wrong. That was fun.
Did you have much fun with 3D Monster Maze as well?
Yes, on the ZX81. Yeah, that was one of the few games. That, and I was amazed by the flight simulator on the ZX81. I remember that blew my mind, that you could actually do a flight simulator on such a limited machine. But yeah, very impressive.
And there's those isometric games, stuff like Ant Attack and Batman on the Spectrum as well. I mean, were you a fan of those?
Yeah, definitely. Ant Attack was a real eye-opener for me because it had the big scrolling area and what looked like 3D graphics, although they weren't. It was quite a departure from the usual Manic Miners and Jet Set Willys. That was quite fun. But for isometric, I think my favourites had to be the Ultimate Play the Game isometrics, such as Sabre Wolf and Alien 8 and things like that. They were just so polished.
When you started programming, do you remember kind of the first games that you made at home then? What kind of titles were you and genres of games were you making at home before you entered the industry professionally?
So tinkering at home in BASIC, mainly before I got my hands dirty with Z80, it was things like overhead. I did a couple of overhead boxing games, that sort of thing, where you just had a very simple character that moved around and a couple of key presses to extend the fist. That was quite simple stuff. Didn't get into 3D at all at that point. Not until I actually started work at Incentive.
Well, let's talk about your move into the industry then. So how did you get involved with Incentive Software?
So that's another interesting one. So I knew from an early stage exactly what I wanted to do for the rest of my life, and that really hasn't changed. So I'm one of the fortunate people who found a passion and a career in that passion. I knew I wanted to be in computers from seeing that ZX81 and tinkering with it. I just didn't know whether I wanted to be in hardware or software. So I took a leap and went to a 2-year course in electronics engineering at a local technical college. Year in, realized I'd made the wrong decision, gone in the wrong direction. Software was much more my thing. I sort of get programming much more than I do electronic signals and components. So I left after the first year and wandered down to the job centre in Basingstoke, where I lived at the time. And on the board was a job posting for Incentive for a computer assistant. I recognised the name straight away from Splat and Confusion. So jumped on that one quickly and got out to Tadley, where I had an interview with Ian and started in the next couple of days.
And do you remember much about the interview and what they had you working on when you first got there?
I certainly remember the interview because it was at the point where the first game from Freescape, the Driller title, was probably around about 70% complete. It was demonstrable in certain forms, and Ian was very, very excited about it. So most of the interview was spent with him showing off what Freescape could do and what they'd achieved, and sort of getting my feedback on it really more than anything. So. But that was really exciting to see that because, as I say, never seen anything 3D anywhere. So to see solid 3D in that form being shown on something like a Spectrum was just mind-blowing.
Yeah, that was Incentive's in-house engine, which was really interesting. It was called Freescape, and that was like the first proprietary 3D engine. How was that kind of developed then?
So I think... At the time, it wasn't particularly common to create what we now refer to as an engine. It's the common way of developing games these days. But back then, you basically created each game as an isolated one-off effort. But Ian had this idea to spend a lot of time up front creating something that could be reused, something quite powerful, and creating an engine that was entirely data-driven. So he came up with the game idea for Driller and built that out from a concept perspective. And Chris Andrew, his brother, was brought on to take on the unenviable task of making the technology work around Ian's fanciful ideas.
Which language is that programmed in then? Was it like pure assembly code? And obviously it was on different platforms as well. Were there any tricks to speed it up and optimize it for each system?
Yeah, it was written in raw Z80 assembly. That was the only way. Well, Z80 assembly on the Spectrum and the Amstrad machines, which is where it started its life, and then was ported across to the Commodore 64 in 6502 by Stephen Northcott. It was developed by Chris. Yes, you do have to take into account a lot of the tricks and techniques at the time, not only to increase the speed, but also to reduce the size of the engine and so on. There was a lot of really nasty self-modifying code within the program, so it would jump around based on various conditions at points where it was drawing the polygons. For example, it would have to different routines for the different stipple patterns. So if you remember in the engine, you had different shades for the different sides of the polygons to give the 3D effect. Mm. So each of those patterns were coded in such a way that we could make modifications to the assembly during runtime to leap into the right place effectively without lots of branches and so on. So there was some really complex tricks going on in the assembly there to make it work as fast as it did.
It was very ahead of its time. And, you know, many games companies didn't actually think of having an engine at that point. Was this kind of incentives plan to have an engine and update it and kind of upgrade it?
Yeah, I think Ian was smart enough to work out from the outset that it was going to take a lot of time and money to get to a point where we could release a game based on this idea, this technology. So it was paramount, really, from a financial perspective, to make sure that you could recoup that cost by releasing more than one game out of it. So he had the idea of building something, putting the work in and the time and the effort and money in up front, and then recouping it over time rather than re-engineering from the ground up each time. And as I say, I don't think many other companies were doing the same thing at the time.
Well, a lot of kind of titles then were, you know, bedroom coders and people doing that. And I guess that enabled the kind of split from a programmer to a kind of video game designer.
Exactly that, yeah. So the way that it was engineered, as I said, it being data driven, so the game itself was contained within a data file that had the objects that you see on screen, the behaviors written in the FCL behavior language that was developed, all encoded within a single data file that gets loaded into the engine and run, meant that Chris and Steve could work on the game itself, the code, the Z80 code behind the game, the loader, the sound, all the different bits and pieces. And at the same time, Ian could be in a completely separate place working with the tools that were provided to him purely on the game design, on the logic, on the puzzles and all those sort of things. And he had the freedom to make changes himself without having to go back to the programmers to make changes and recompile it and produce a new version and get it back to him. So the turnaround time on making changes and tweaks to the game and improving things was much faster, and that allowed him to be much more creative.
You know, it still blows my mind that this was running on systems like the Spectrum and the Amstrad CPC. I mean, how hard was it to compress and get as much information to be displayed in like a 3D world on such limited hardware?
That was a huge challenge, absolutely. And it's all down to the data formats that were designed. So rather than using, for example, for the position of an object, because each of the regions, so you had the sides of the moon in Driller, for example, is one region. It's a limited grid, 3D grid space with limited coordinates. So rather than using 3 bytes for the X, Y, and Z, we would actually compress it down to 1 or 2 bytes using just the bits that were required to do it. And similar techniques were used throughout the entire data structure. So for simple shapes, you'd use compressed bit representations. You'd use flags in groups of eight to control various things, rather than losing a byte, you'd just lose a single bit. Use a single bit within there for the purpose. And within the FCL language itself as well, the commands and the bytecodes that make up the virtual machine of the FCL language were very optimized to maximize each individual bit within the data that was created.
I was wondering, with the kind of cassette storage format as well, you had to, you know, to create bigger worlds, you had to have that real efficiency.
So when we were developing it, it was developed largely on the Amstrad CPCs. So Chris would develop mostly on the CPC, and Ian would create the game on another CPC, which meant we had access to the 3-inch discs. So that made it a lot easier to work like that.
I've heard that from a lot of people that actually, you know, developed Spectrum titles on the Amstrad and kind of moved the code over, because it was just a nicer machine to work on, I guess, physically. That keyboard as well, I imagine, helped.
Yeah, and I think if I remember rightly, I mean, it's all a bit blurry, it's a long time ago, but if I remember rightly, there was actually peripherals that you could purchase, and we did, that you plugged into the Amstrad that would allow you to connect directly to the Spectrum, so we could assemble on the Amstrad with all of its additional memory and disk facilities to a Spectrum program that could then be dumped straight down to an actual Spectrum to run. So the Amstrads were the workhorses of the development process.
Well, you mentioned Driller, also known as Space Station Oblivion, in America. That was the first title on Freescape with up and down looking abilities in the game too. I mean, was that considered a bit of a practice ground or a tech demo for the engine?
I don't think it was necessarily that way around. I think Ian did have the idea for the game and then worked with Chris to come up with the best way to develop the technology to make that game work. So it wasn't so much a case of let's build Freescape and then let's create a game on it. It was more, this is the game I want to build. Let's build an engine and then we'll call it Freescape.
I was wondering, going onto those different systems, porting the engine, did that make the process of porting games like much quicker? And porting the engine itself, was that a bit of a challenge?
So porting between Amstrad and Spectrum was very simple because they're both based on Z80 cores. So the vast majority of the engine itself was common between the two. A lot of what you do in a 3D engine such as Freescape is not specific to any particular platform. You do transforms between, you're transforming 3D objects in 3D space, doing rotations and transformations and scaling operations in 3D space. You're then transforming those points into 2D space through a projection matrix. Then you're having to scan down the resulting polygons, the edges of the resulting polygons, producing a list of horizontal lines to draw. And then you draw those horizontal lines pixel by pixel. It's only when you get down to the pixel by pixel part of the horizontal line draw that you get into machine specifics. So within the code, the Z80 code, those machine specific parts were isolated with just ifdefs effectively in the assembly code that the assembler would compile in and out or out depending on which platform you were targeting. Obviously going to the Commodore 64 and the 6502, that was a complete rewrite, obviously, completely different architecture and different considerations as well. The C64 ran a slower clock speed and had some interesting features that we could take advantage of.
So each different system, like say the Amiga and stuff, you'd be adding in like extra functions with the Blitter and specific stuff for those systems.
Yeah, there wasn't a great deal we could take advantage of with the Blitter on the Amiga, unfortunately, because it was designed for 2D. I don't know if we did. I think we experimented with some ideas of hardware accelerating the horizontal line draw, but in the end, it just didn't work out. It's just not designed for that sort of thing. So I think it was pretty much still CPU bound, and that's why some people felt that on the 16-bit machines, it didn't go as fast as they expected it to.
Would like accelerator cards help it and stuff? Because I know some titles were like limited, but you know, if you had a faster machine, would it run better?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So there were various 6800XO boards that you could plug into the Amiga that ran at much faster speeds. And yes, because the machine, the game itself was CPU bound, any speed increase at the CPU level would have a direct effect on the speed of the game. So, for example, modern emulators running the Spectrum or the Amiga version clocked up higher than normal would run really nice.
You know, obviously you were doing 3D way ahead of everybody else. And by the time we got into the mid-90s, I mean, you know, 3D was everywhere. And a lot of companies fell by the wayside because they couldn't keep up with the demands of making 3D games. I mean, when you saw these initial titles that you were doing at Incentive, I mean, did that kind of look like it was going to be the future of the industry? Did you get kind of an idea that 3D is where it was all heading?
Yeah, I think we did. And that sort of led our decision to move towards Superscape and the more advanced stuff that we did. I think Ian had a very clear picture of where more immersive 3D technologies was going to go. Unfortunately, I feel looking back, we were, and his vision was maybe a little bit too far ahead of the curve. The machines weren't capable of what we wanted to do, what we had in mind. But yeah, he certainly had a clear picture that 3D was going to be the thing.
In gaming history, a lot of people look at, like, you know, the wireframe games, Battlezone and stuff like that, and then they go into, like, later titles like Wolfenstein and Doom and see that. Do you think games like Castle Master have been a bit overlooked in that sense?
I think they probably have, and I think that's more because they weren't the high-speed, frantic experience that the gamers in those days really were looking for. It was much more puzzle, thought-based, because it was at a lower pace. Much more effort was put into designing complex puzzles that were difficult to solve. And at the time, people wanted twitch, fast-action things. So it sort of had a niche, and it had a bit of a following, but no, it didn't take off or get noticed quite as much as the faster-paced games, that's for sure.
And amazingly, it reminds me of something actually like Myst, or one of the kind of later titles, which was kind of a like pre-rendered slideshowy one where this was in a full environment you could go around. Yeah, it was quite groundbreaking, Castle Master.
Yeah, I think Castle Master in particular was a leap forward for Incentive as well because of the complexity of the puzzles involved. Ian sort of honed his skills, brought on other people, and took ideas from other areas that made it much more of a complex puzzle experience.
Well, in 1988, Darkside came out, and that was the sequel to Driller. What are your memories of working on that project then? What's kind of the story behind that game?
That, for me, was more of a small iteration over Driller. In fact, if I remember rightly, most of what happened between Driller and Darkside was just Ian working with the tools he already had. I don't think there was a great deal of change in the engine. We had new graphics and we had new surround and things like that and so on. But it was largely a proof of the fact that this idea of separating the game design and the game programming was a valuable one, because in developing Darkside, Ian was more or less able just to take what he had and develop a new game on it without involving Chris at all, Chris or Stephen.
And you had Total Eclipse, obviously, that was around the same time too. I mean, any memories of that game?
Yeah, I think what probably happened there, if I remember rightly, is that while Ian was working on Darkside, which was a natural progression from Driller, there was more work going on in the background on the engine to support the next sequence of games, which was Castle Master and Total Eclipse. So that's where the development time was going on, making sure that the engine was ready for the next generation while just taking advantage of what we already had in Freescape version 1.0, if you like, for Darkside.
Because, you know, Total Eclipse as well, I mean, being a 1988 video game, that was really, I mean, you could consider that by today's standards as a first-person shooter. I mean, it's got all the elements there.
Yeah, that was the first one we did, Freescape, where we had a prize as well, if I remember rightly. The trip to Egypt to see the total eclipse.
Oh, wow. Do you remember? Did someone win that?
Anybody win that?
They did. I can't remember the name, unfortunately. But yeah, someone won that. And now that I remember that aspect of it, that's almost certainly what led Ian to developing Total Eclipse as a game concept, knowing that there was an upcoming solar eclipse that he could use as a marketing tool.
Well, Castle Master was an absolutely kind of stunning title. Why do you think it was so successful and probably the most famous title out of all of these?
As I say, I think it was probably the fact that Ian's familiarity with the system and how to get the most out of it sort of developed over time. He worked out how to be... He was always incredibly devious with his puzzles anyway, but once he worked out what you could and couldn't do with the engine and how you could... do silly little things like make shapes almost touch but not, and leave these little gaps that are imperceptible from a distance. But if you get to the right place and crouch down, you can get through there. He learned all these tricks, and that just made his ability to develop devious puzzles far, far better. And that's why you end up with a game that's just much more difficult to complete and much more fun.
And it had all those like cool little elements like catapults and stuff that really made it feel real, you know.
Yeah, that was really good fun trying to get recognizable objects out of such a limited palette of tools. But yeah, it was really good to see some of these things come together and recognize them.
One thing that stood out to me that still stands out today was Matt Furness's soundtrack, which was just absolutely amazing. And that tune was so atmospheric. I absolutely love it. I still play it today. What was it like when you guys first heard that music?
Yeah, I remember when it was first delivered and we loaded it up on the Amiga. The sound of the bells at the very start was just, it was mind-blowing. It sounded great, absolutely fantastic. So clean and crisp. It sounded great on the Amiga, as you'd expect, because that's what it was authored on. But my memory of it is actually getting it to work so well on the Atari ST, because it had much more limited sound capabilities than the Amiga. But we managed to create something that would play roughly four channels and make it sound not too dissimilar to the Amiga, which was really, really quite a pleasing achievement.
Was there a prize with Castle Master as well?
I don't think there was. I think we only did. I don't recall one. I know we did one for Total Eclipse, but I don't remember there being one for Castle Master.
And these exotic holidays are not cheap. Not doing for every game.
No, they're not.
I'm sure you can find a castle to go to quite cheap.
Well, obviously you got the sequel in the same year as well, remarkably, both in 1990, Castle Master 2, The Crypt. What was that kind of in development at the same time or straight after then? How did that quick release schedule work, and how did you want to improve on the original game?
So I think, again, that was very much like the Driller to Darkside evolution. That was just Ian sitting in his office with lots of reams of paper and pencils and sketching out the game and developing it in the tools he had with no input from, or no minimal input from the developers. Because I think at that time, the developers, all of us, were switching focus to Superscape. So really, Castle Master 2 was the swan song of the Freescape engine, and Ian could do that in isolation because the tools were already well honed and ready for him to use.
Well, I thought that the ST Adventure Creator was a really interesting title, and like how was that developed, but also how did that kind of lead to Incentive wanting to create game creation programs?
So the ST Adventure Creator actually was a follow-up to... Well, not a follow-up, it was a port of the GAC, the Graphic Adventure Creator, which was on the Amstrad and the Spectrum, I think the Commodore as well. But that was developed by an incredibly smart guy called Sean Ellis. About the same time we were developing Freescape, but he didn't work for Incentive at the time. He worked as a freelancer, and we just published it for him. But some interesting anecdotes around the GAC in particular. It was written on an Amstrad CPC in Z80. But being a university student and operating out of his dorm, Sean didn't have the funds to even buy something as rudimentary as an assembler. So everything was written in, hand-coded in hex, He knew, and even more recently, when I had a chance to speak to him before he unfortunately passed a couple of years ago, he still knew most of the Z80 assembly code in hex form, and could actually code things by typing in hex values, which was just phenomenal.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
Well, 3D construction kit obviously went on to be a massive hit for Incentive. And I remember so much hype around that product when it was released. What was the idea behind that then? And how was that developed into a product for the end user?
So I think we had the idea to put the Freescape engine out for people to play with fairly early on, maybe not at the very, very start, but sort of certainly after a couple of games had proven to be successful and had an audience. We sort of had the idea that it would be good at some point to take the tools that we've put together that Ian uses on a daily basis to create the games and let other people get creative and have fun. So once we decided that the Freescape engine itself in its various forms had run its course, it would make sense then to package it up into something that we could put out and let other people have some fun. So it was myself and another programmer worked on the development of it, and a designer we had on board called Eugene Messina, a very, very creative guy, had a real eye for user interface design and user experience. He came up with the way that the engine, the application would work, how you'd interact with it, what it would look like and feel like, and we just coded up the tools we already had. We developed some of them into more friendly forms. So when placing objects, for example, in the original tools, Ian would have to type in coordinates. So we added some tools to be able to select an object and move it around with arrow keys and controls on the screen, just to make it more friendly. And the FCL behavior language, Ian would type that in hex. He'd have a reference sheet next to him of all the different opcodes and what they did, and he'd type it in hex, whereas obviously not particularly useful for the average user. So we developed a very simple assembler that could take human-readable commands and compile them down to the FCL bytecodes, packaged that all up, and luckily we found something that people enjoy playing with.
I think it is really important, that interface, because... you know, 3D was something that I always wanted to pick up, and there were lots of 3D modeling programs on the Amiga and stuff, but it just had that kind of pick up and play vibe, and it was always something that you'd go back to when you felt overwhelmed with other games and systems.
It was certainly something that we were aiming for, was that anybody, literally anybody, could pick it up and just do something, even if you don't create a game. Just build something. But people were building their houses, people were building cars and all sorts of things with it just for fun, and that was great, and it meant that we got the balance just right, that people could pick it up and it made sense, and it wasn't too complicated, it wasn't too onerous, it didn't take a huge learning curve. And I think we followed that through most of our 3D and our engineering in as we moved into Superscape. The VRT itself was supremely usable. And I still say now, I was speaking to Ian very recently, and I said, even now I would stand the VRT version 5 alongside Unity in terms of usability, because it was just so friendly.
I was wondering as well, like with stuff like maybe draw distance and stuff, I always remember there was a bit of a limit with what you could build, and you know, you'd always have these grand designs, and then kind of your memory limitation and stuff would limit you. Did that change depending on which system you used?
Sure, we tried to make sure that we could take advantage of whatever was available. So if you were on an Amiga, for example, you had much more freedom, and moreover, you had much more granularity. So the regions that you built within were a cubic area. And on the 8-bit machines, that was cut up into, I think it was 128 by 128 segments, and that's what you had to build in. You could get no more granular than that, and there was no rotation or anything. Whereas on the 16-bit machines, we increased the resolution of that to much more granular grids within that region, so you could build things with a little bit more detail. And having the extra memory meant that you could go a little bit more overboard on adding detail, bearing in mind that it would obviously slow things down, but gave you a little bit more freedom, certainly.
So no 3D construction kit. I mainly see it today talked about as an Amiga and a Commodore 64 product mainly. That seems to be like the main audience that remember it. But I actually do have a vivid memory of IT class in school. I think one of my teachers showing me it on an Acorn Archimedes.
Yeah.
And was that ever a consideration, the kind of educational market? Because it's quite interesting that it came out on the Acorn as well.
Not so much for Freescape, but certainly when we moved into Superscape, non-gaming applications were a consideration and were our main focus, actually. We moved out of gaming dramatically from there. But no, I think I don't think we actually targeted education or anything. We just basically put something out that people could play with, and it was fun to see all the different things people did with it.
Well, it was also known as Virtual Reality Studio when it was released in the USA, which, you know, for 1991, I'd never heard the term virtual reality. Obviously, it was everywhere a couple of years later and even more so today. Why the name change then, and where did that come from?
I can't remember for sure whether it was an Ian idea or a Domark idea, but Domark, our publisher, typically recommended different naming for the US market that would fit their demographics. So I suspect it was probably something that Domark came up with.
What were the kind of differences between the 8 and 16-bit, and which port did you prefer, or you kind of thought was the best version?
So I'd say the main differences really were the available resolution you had in the 3D space. Apart from that, we tried to keep them, or we had to, we were really forced to keep them pretty similar in terms of feature set. There may be some additional bits and pieces that were available in the 16-bit ones, but it was mainly about additional resolution and space to build. In terms of favorite, I think my favorite was probably the Amiga one, just because I've just got fond memories of that machine. It looked great, it felt great. The machine itself was just fun.
Well, today, if we want to find out how to use a product, generally the way I do it is type it into YouTube and watch a video tutorial. But back then, usually you got a massive manual that was like the size of a phone book for the more complex programs. But you actually did a VHS explainer tape and a newsletter as well, explaining how to use a software and helping users get to grips with it. I mean, where did that idea come from, and how important was that? Was it received well by the users?
That was another Ian idea, definitely. And I think he was the star of the show. I think it was well received. I think people did enjoy the fact that they could see someone using it. And maybe that took away a little bit of the fear factor, because 3D back then was a buzzword that would put a lot of people off. While some people would find it exciting and futuristic, others would find it scary. So I think having someone just talk you through, literally talk you through how simple it is to use was quite a smart move. And it certainly seemed to be well received. People gave very, very positive feedback for the video and how it helped them.
There were two example games with it, and they were pretty impressive themselves. But I was wondering how important it was to help people, you know, customize it, create their own identity. And I knew that you could do an overlay and change some of the buttons around. But also in the second version, I think you could add sound effects and your own music as well.
Yeah. So having the ability to do your own overlay, your own image file that you created for the dashboard effectively of the game, was absolutely critical, because what we wanted to create ultimately was a tool that allowed people to create their own games, not just a modified version of Driller or Darkside or anything like that. We wanted them to come up with the idea and make it their own, and being able to put their own stamp on the front, if you like, with their own graphics, their own design, their own layout, being able to move where the controls were and how they responded, where the GUI feedback elements were on the screen and how they worked, and tie that into the FCL so you could print things in different places and update scores and so on, made it so flexible and so customizable that people were able to create games that, although were recognizably Freescape because of the nature of the 3D window in the middle, were at the same time unique to them and their own take on that particular genre.
Well, I remember a lot of people getting very excited about it, and I even remember seeing a cover disc, I think, on Amiga Format that obviously helped awareness of 3D Construction Kit, I imagine. Do you remember anything that kind of impressed you, and were you getting a lot of games and creations that people have made sent in on disc regularly?
Yeah, I think we did. We did certainly get some games sent in to us to review or to show off, if you like. People liked showing off what they were creating, and we were very keen to get that and see what people were using. I don't have any particular memories of any particular games, and that's a bit bad, really, in a way. But we were focused very much on Superscape at the time. So while we hadn't abandoned Freescape, we were still keeping an eye on what was going on in the community and enjoying seeing it being being used in the various ways it was. We were very focused on the next level.
I think there is a website as well, isn't there, where you can download a lot of these games, Ravi, if people want to?
Yeah, 3dconstructionkit.co.uk, and that has a lot of games for all the different systems, actually. And there's one that I've always wanted to do, which would have been like a kind of Western town. I thought that would have been a cool idea.
Yeah, I think we did have some other ideas for other games, but I think Ian took the decision that it had done its job. It was time to move on to something else, and you didn't want to keep pushing it too hard, and people get fed up with seeing Freescape games, and the name sort of gets tarnished. So we decided that was the right place to stop.
Well, 3D Construction Kit 2, obviously that came out in 1992, and you dropped the 8-bit platforms by then. So it was Amiga, Atari ST, and PC. And that had a load of improvements as well. I mean, what kind of new features did you put in there, and how difficult were they to implement? Was that like a reason that the 8-bit support was dropped?
It was absolutely a reason the 8-bit support was dropped. There was no way we could continue improving the engine in meaningful ways within the constraints of those 8-bit platforms, but we could on the 16-bit. So we introduced things like transparency. I think we had some rotational capabilities in there. We had to change fundamentally the way the engine worked in some ways, because transparency introduces its own problems. You have to make sure that you draw each surface in the right order. Backface culling and all these other things are become much more relevant with a simple solid, well, relatively simple solid engine. You just draw the polygons back to front, and they overdraw one another, and that's fine. Anything that should be hidden is hidden by the fact that it's drawn over. With transparency, that's no longer a luxury you can take advantage of. So you had to be able to sort things effectively, come up with some very complex sorting algorithms to efficiently sort the polygons and make sure that the transparent ones were drawn in the right order, so that you could see through the stipple pattern to the objects behind.
I was thinking, you know, the Freescape engine games would be fantastic on a like modern VR system. I saw Dactyl Nightmare ended up getting on one, and I just think those retro kind of worlds are like really suited to it. I'd love to play Castle Master on a, you know, Quest or something. It'd be amazing.
Yeah, I agree. I think getting the puzzles and the gameplay and bring it into a more immersive environment would be really good fun. I think Ian did a great job of drawing you into the games, in particular in Castle Master, with some of the characters and the narrative. I think being able to bring that into something where you're literally immersed would be great fun.
Are you a virtual reality enthusiast these days, then?
I am, very much, yeah. Well, I say very much. I'm Oculus Quest 2. I sidestepped the whole tethered VR thing. I know it's much more powerful. You've got a big powerful gaming PC and you get some great VR, but I couldn't see myself being tied to a machine.
Yeah, I've got the I've got an Oculus, which is my most used VR headset, but I've also got a PlayStation VR, but it took me about half an hour to plug all the cables into it the first time I set it up, I think. Yeah, I think wireless is definitely the way to go there. Yeah. But one thing I know you did recently, you currently are working on a retro makes challenge. So tell us about this, because this sounds really exciting.
Yeah, so this came from some of the work I did a couple of years ago on game jams. I got into a mode where I wanted to tinker with games again, having been out of the industry for a little while. And did a few game jams. I found producing games under a tight schedule to an externally imposed guideline was quite fun. I decided I wanted to do something a little bit more. So I came up with the idea of doing, pushing myself to do a game a month for 12 months and see what I could come up with. But as I started planning it out, I found it very challenging to come up with 12 different unique games. So this was just at the time when the Spectrum was entering its 40th anniversary, and there was a lot of press about that. So it occurred to me maybe the thing to do would be, rather than coming up with 12 games, to pick 12 classics from the Spectrum era and remake them in a modern way. So using modern techniques, but trying to remain faithful to the fun original game that people loved so much back in those days. So I'm doing that now. I'm in month 5 of 12 at the moment, and I've just about managed to deliver each one. Literally the last one, Splat, I delivered 2 minutes before midnight on the 31st. So, nice. It was a close one, but yeah.
Which other titles have you done then so far?
So I did Confusion to begin with, which was an incentive published title. What did I follow up with? I've done Confusion, High Noon, Splat, and I'm currently doing Death Chase.
Nice. There'll be like 12 in total then, will there?
Yes, yeah.
Right, cool.
And Driller's among them, actually.
How have you found the process of doing them then? Have you had to play the originals then and kind of update the style and kind of... I imagine retaining kind of the gameplay and feel of the originals is a bit of a challenge, is it?
It is, yeah. And that's half the fun. So each time the month starts, I spend a couple of days at the very start of it just playing the game on an emulator. And it's really... It takes you back, definitely takes you back to playing those games. And it opens your eyes just to how creative the games designers and programmers were back in those days, developing such engaging games, such fun games to play on such limited systems with such limited resources. It meant they had to become really creative in how they designed the game and how they made the game feel and play, because the graphics can't be photorealistic, the sound can't be awesome. So you had to engage the player purely in gameplay. So hats off to the developers of those games. The creativity they engaged in was just phenomenal.
I was just wondering, have you got your hands on a Spectrum Next yet?
I missed out on the first round, but I'm fully in on the second Kickstarter. I'm just waiting for it to arrive, which will be sometime late next year, thanks to the chip shortages. But yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I shall certainly be playing with that and seeing what I can make.
Yeah, I'm in line with you as well. I know it'll be worth the wait, though. I've had a lot of play Expo and that kind of thing before, so it's a really interesting machine. I mean, do you think you'll make some titles for that then? Is that kind of your plan?
I'd like to, yeah. I'd like to get back to doing some Z80. I've been practicing a little bit on some emulators, and I've heard Driller runs really nicely on it as well, if you clock it up to its 25 megahertz highest.
Fantastic. Well, what are you up to these days professionally then?
I've jumped around a little bit. So I spent 19 years of my career at Incentive and Superscape. So that was more than half of my working life in one place, which was phenomenal. I then jumped around a little bit, did some work on TV and film special effects, jumped back into VR on the retail side, so the commercial side rather than the consumer side. Did some other bits and pieces. Recently got back together with Ian Andrew, where we did some prototyping and released a mobile game just to see what the market was like these days. And now I'm freelancing, doing what takes my fancy on a day-to-day basis, just having fun coding things, mostly games, but whatever comes along.
Well, Paul, it's incredible to hear that the passion for gaming still burns deep. If people want to check out the retro makes that you've done so far, where can they get them from?
So everything I do is centered on my personal site, which is indigobeetle.co.uk. That's where I blog about them, not as frequently as I'd like to, but as much as I'm able to. And they can all be linked from there, and they're all hosted on itch, but the personal site will link through to those games if you want to have a play.
Brilliant. Well, I'll put that link in our show notes. Everyone should definitely go and check it out. And, you know, can't wait to see what you do with the rest of it as well. Good luck with that project, and thank you so much for coming on and sharing some of your memories. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, Paul.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Really, really good to dig back to some of those good old times.